first case for the December oral arguments, 97-3467, Rita Roth versus the City of Glendale. And according to my schedule here, Mr. Nugent will argue 18 minutes for the petitioners, Rita Roth et al. Mr. Hawks will argue 7 minutes. And then we will have argument by Ms. Snuslock for 30 minutes. And Mr. Nugent, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is that correct? Okay. We'll start with you, Mr. Nugent, please.
May it please the court, if I can introduce me, my name is Alvin Nugent, and I'm the attorney for the retirees of the City of Glendale, who are the plaintiffs in this action. I might also add that some of the plaintiffs are not bargaining unit people, but were either supervisory or at least outside of the bargaining unit. So we have a mixture. It's not just union people that have commenced this action. Matter of fact, they all commenced the action because they all were claimed that they were denied health insurance benefits that were promised to them while they worked there. I'd say back in 1978, when I actually had the time to read every Supreme Court decision that was issued, I used to read them and took note of them when the case didn't involve something that I was directly involved in. And Schlosser versus Alice Chalmers was one of those cases. I don't know why, but it always stuck in my mind. And when I got the call from the Glendale retirees, I didn't remember the name Schlosser, but I remembered the name Alice Chalmers, and it took me a few minutes, and I found the case. And I immediately felt that that case is identical to the case that we are now here in this court, except that I felt our case is even stronger than the Schlosser case. In Schlosser, the people claimed, in that case, life insurance benefit, and they claimed it by virtue of the fact that there was a brochure that was probably handed to them at the time they went to work for Alice Chalmers. That particular brochure clearly indicated that Alice Chalmers had a right to amend or modify or even eliminate that life insurance benefit, and they didn't, though. So over the years, these were supervisory employees. They continued to work for Alice Chalmers, and then they retired, and Alice Chalmers paid the premium for a while, but then stopped. And this Supreme Court ruled that once the employees retired, once they quit working for Alice Chalmers, the benefit was vested, and Alice Chalmers no longer had a right to cancel it, as they did. Now, in our case, we're dealing with, at least some of the employees, we're dealing with a union contract. And I will admit that the contract nowhere uses the word vesting. And as a matter of fact, I don't recall seeing that word very often in any contract. I just don't recall seeing the word vesting. Normally, it's not the name that counts, but it's the language that's involved that determines whether or not a person is vested. Over the years, I never found it very complicated to learn whether somebody is vested or not. Usually, it's the number of years.
I'd like to ask one question. When you said that there is very little difference between this case and the Alice Chalmers case, in Alice Chalmers, that was the unilateral action just by the employer, by Alice Chalmers.
Started out that way. Yes.
You just stated that. And here you have, well, collective bargaining agreements, one after the other. And isn't that a difference that these changes that we're talking about were authorized by the union itself? That the changes in the collective bargaining agreement were authorized by the union, where the company itself, this was a unilateral, that in itself seems to mean, to me at least, that there is a difference between this case and the Schlosser case.
I guess what I meant was there are no material differences in the two situations. It's true that the union, they didn't authorize it. They negotiated successive contracts. And in the case of Alice Chalmers, they unilaterally offered the benefit. However, it ripened into a contract because the employees worked the requisite number of years. And when they completed their work, actually the court viewed that as a contract. So there are differences, but as I will point out as I go along, I don't believe the differences are material.
Well, counsel, who represented your clients, the retirees, when these collective bargaining agreements were made after these people retired?
They had a union representing them. Yeah.
I thought the union can't represent retired people.
Oh, no, not the retirees. He represented the workers who then later retired.
I know, but then once they retired and the new collective bargaining agreement came up and changed the benefits of the retirees, who represented the retirees at the collective bargaining agreement?
No one. They were not represented.
So in essence, then, when there was a new collective bargaining agreement, as to the retired people, it was a unilateral act by the employer.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, the changes that were made to the agreement after they retired were not significant changes as far as the retirees were concerned. For example, they changed they claimed the right to change the insurance company, the carrier, and that really made no difference to the retirees because the benefits had to remain the same. So these changes that were made, nothing happened. The retirees didn't object because it didn't really have any effect on them. It wasn't until this last change that it made a severe change in their benefits, and that's why they objected. I think they conceivably could have objected before, but the change didn't have any effect on them. I would point out that the benefits that we're talking about are not, call them employee benefits, you can also call them employer benefits, because these benefits are used to retain employees. When you set up a benefit or a plan and you set up a number of years that the person has to work in order to earn that benefit, if some other employer tries to take that person away by offering them more money or whatever, they will probably not be successful because the employee knows they've got 3, 4, 5 years or more in on the plan. So these benefits are used to retain good and qualified employees. Now, when they changed...
Sorry. What relief are you requesting in this case? What do you want us to do?
I'm asking that you find that the change in benefits to the retirees, that they be canceled and that they be placed in the position that they were before and that they be made whole for all of the money that they've had to pay in order to keep their coverage in effect.
If I recall correctly, the union brief takes a different posture, and understandably so, you know, you're not representing the same interests. It takes the posture set forth in the majority opinion of Biblock and says, look, you look to the language first, and it's the language on the issue of vesting. And here, they still argue, there's nothing that says it vests or you don't vest. This is a contract. Our goal as a court is to interpret the contract so that it's consistent with the intent of the parties. If you can't tell what the intent is by the language, then the union argues consistent with Biblock. You go to extrinsic evidence. You take testimony. You're not arguing that. You're saying
that you can tell from the language that the intent was to give them lifetime health insurance benefits. And right on point.
And so where is that language?
Okay, right on point. They said, right here.
Where's the language that says it vests?
Every one of the it doesn't use the word vests, but every contract that they have says retired employees will be eligible for the health insurance benefit provided. And then it says they have to work 10 years initially, and then they changed it in January 1, 1987. They changed it to 15 years. And then it says the retiree must be at least 58 years of age.
Do you concede there is no specific language that you can point to in any of these 11 contracts that says there is vesting for your client?
There is no language that uses that word. There is language that sets up the requirements for vesting, and that, I believe, establishes vesting. Contracts do not usually use the word
Don't
vesting.
You have to resort to some case law argument on that and not just stay with the words itself? Well, I mean, you can't find the words vesting in your contracts.
Well, it's just that, well, this is the Supreme Court, and this is where we make law if we don't have it now. And
do you have a problem with going the route of the union? That is, they would argue to remand this for the taking of testimony to see what the intent of the parties is, and if that's inconclusive, then go to the presumptions that each side is arguing.
I have no problem with that at all. It's far superior to what I have so far. I have no problem with going back because I'm very satisfied that if you question the people at the bargaining table, as we would, you would find that none of them were talking about the retirees' benefits. So I have no problem going back and doing that. But all I can say is that when the employer changed it from 10 years to 15 years, what in heaven's name were they doing? What's the importance of changing it from 10 to 15 if they're not vested anyway? There would be no reason to do that. And the reason they changed it from 10 to 15 is that they wanted to make it more difficult to become vested. Otherwise, it would be a fraud on the workers. What is the point in telling them, you work here 15 years, if they could work there 50 years and they still won't be vested if their vesting depends on the renewal of the labor agreement?
Mr. Ugent, let me, if I might, interrupt for a minute and ask you, what is the significant point that you claim vesting occurs? When does vesting occur?
I'm following the decision of Schlesser, which said that the time they retire. Before that, I would have argued that when they complete the 10 or 15 years and they reach the appropriate age. But Schlesser ruled that at the time of retirement, the employer no longer has the right to change the benefits. So that's my contention, is that it's the time of retirement. And when these people retired, they all retired with the belief that they would get the insurance coverage that was promised to them. Now, in all of the briefs opposite of mine, you will see reference to SAN, which is cited in all the briefs. In all of those cases, I see sunset language, a language that negotiators refer to as sunset language. It says, for the term of the agreement. Now, you won't find that kind of language in our agreement, just the opposite. You find language that says the employee recontribution remains a negotiable item upon the expiration of this agreement.
Mr. Eugene, let me follow through a little bit. You say that the time of retirement is a significant time for vesting. Does that mean that whatever the collective bargaining agreement says at that time applies to that particular retiree?
Yes, sir, because up until that date, that employee had some voice in what the agreement is going to say. So I would say that after that, the retired person is gone, is no longer an employee and no longer a member of any bargaining unit. So up to that point, the retiree had something to say about what benefits they would have. But so I believe the date of retirement sets the date of vesting.
And controls the benefits.
Yes.
Could I ask you a question, Mr. Eugen? There was a point where there was a change in the collective bargaining agreement to permit a different provider than Blue Cross.
Yes.
If one retired before that change in the contract, would it be your position that the provider had to be Blue Cross?
To be consistent, yes. However, it's the kind of a change that normally no one's going to object to because At the same time they allowed them to change provider, they also agreed that the benefits would remain the same. And there have been numerous arbitration decisions allowing employers to change the provider, provided the benefits remain the same. So sometimes they can even be done unilaterally without any agreement. But normally, I would say that once the person retires, and if he was promised a certain provider and promised a certain coverage, that shouldn't be changed without the agreement of the retiree. Now, what's upsetting mostly about this case is the language in the Court of Appeals decision that says the union somehow represents the employee or the retired employee, and they do that by some kind of apparent authority. Now, I can't find anyone on either side of the bargaining table. I can't find an employer or a retired person that would agree with that. In fact, the language is opposite, isn't it? It says the contribution remains a negotiable item. Well, who is the employer going to negotiate with? Can't negotiate with the union, because, as a matter of fact, in this very case, there were 20 things that were negotiated and bargained. And if you've been in collective bargaining, you know there are trade-offs going on all the time. So that meant that the union may have won other benefits for the active workers and then gave up a benefit for the retired workers. So if there's going to, the employer, by the way, they don't have that language in the most recent agreements that that I see attached to the employer's brief, but at the time, they said they reserved the right to negotiate. And I would say, even if you feel that the employee or the retired employees are not vested, since they had there's a requirement that there be a negotiation for the change in benefits, I believe that if they're going to change the benefits, even if the employee is not vested, that they would have to negotiate that change with the retired people, because that's what they were promised. And if they had negotiated with the retired people, that would have avoided the problem. Now, there is a case of Vance versus the City of Milwaukee that held that the retired people have no right to be at the bargaining table. But in that case, there was negotiations by a union for retroactive benefits that the retired people didn't have when they were retired. They wanted to be at the bargaining table to actively try to win new benefits. And the court said that they have no right to do that. And we're not saying that the retirees, that the Glendale people, have a right to be at the bargaining table with the union. They have a right to be at their own bargaining table. And in the Allied Chemical Company case that I cited, that's exactly what happened. The employer there went directly to the retired people and negotiated with the retired people and, for the most part, changed their benefits with their full consent and agreement. And what the union there objected to was going around them. And the Supreme Court held it's perfectly proper to negotiate with the retired people. In fact, in this case, since since they reserved the right to negotiate, I say the negotiations have to take place not at the same bargaining table as with the union, but at a separate bargaining table for the retired people. Otherwise, I believe the benefits have to remain the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Student. Mr. Hawks. Mr. Student did not apparently use all of his minutes, so that would be 25. Thank you.
May it please the court.
Mr. Hawks, you are representing District Council 40 as amicus curiae, and that you are given permission for this oral argument by Mr. Eugent to share his time.
We thank Mr. Eugent and plaintiffs for granting us this opportunity to address the court.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Timothy E. Hawks and the law firm of Schneiman Myers, appearing on behalf of Amicus Curiae, District Council 40 of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and other labor organizations appearing as Amicus Curiae. Plaintiffs, mostly former union members, addressed their interests with regard to their individual rights in this case. Amici speak of their interest as unions and of the consequences that they believe the Court of Appeals decision and holding will have on the relationships between them as unions and public employers in the state of Wisconsin. They arise because they believe that the Court of Appeals departed from its appropriate role in this case. The court should have required a trial to discern the actual intent of the parties. Or it should have sifted and winnowed the facts available to it to draw a reasonable inference from them with regard to the party's intent. Instead, it improperly engaged in legislation. It legislated industrial policy by adopting a wholly new presumption of contract interpretation. It then applied that presumption to labor contracts, which made years or even decades earlier than its decision. Amici have 3 points to make in this brief time. The first is that they believe there will be an unintended consequence of the Court of Appeals holding if it is affirmed by this court. They fear that tens of thousands of their members now run the probable risk of a diminution, if not the outright loss, of their retirement benefits, defeating their reasonable expectations. In order to prevent this from happening, Amici fear that they will be required to shoulder the burden of renegotiating contract benefits they thought they had already bargained for. They fear that they will have to offer concessions again on top of the concessions that they provided public employers previously for these benefits. And then they can do these things only for their current members. The worst aspect of the holding is that Amici can do nothing as a matter of legal right to fix the problem created by this decision for those of their members who have already retired. They can do nothing to help Rita Roth and the plaintiffs in this case. The second point is that the Court of Appeals holding creates a two-tier benefit scheme such that non-unionized employees will enjoy vested lifetime retiree benefits under Schlosser, whereas union members will never enjoy them for long, if at all. Third, the Court of Appeals holding reverses long-standing precedent creating an agency relationship between retirees and a union, whether or not the union accepts the role, whether or not the employer agrees to the role, whether or not the employees are even former union members.
What relation does this have to the state retirement system? I don't want to get personal, but we get a retirement plan. Employees retire under promises of what they're going to get, or they think they're promises of what they're going to get. Can the state then change its mind?
Your Honor, I don't hold myself out as an expert in the state retirement system, but I have some experience.
Okay. But
I understand that the state retirement system has, in a sense, an adjunct relationship with the with health insurance benefit systems administered by the state of Wisconsin for its employees. Under the CELRA, the State Employee Labor Relations Act, found in Section 11180 and following in the state statutes, the unions of state employees and the state of Wisconsin have a duty to bargain collectively regarding changes in that system, although I believe that there are limitations on that bargaining process, such that notification must be given well in advance of termination of an existing collective bargaining agreement to negotiate a change. It is my opinion or judgment, viewing the experiences I have seen, I do negotiate labor contracts for one union of state employees and advise three others. From my experience, oftentimes the largest of the state unions, District Council 24 of the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, will engage in negotiations with the Department of Employment Relations with regard to insurance benefits. Those are subsequently adopted by statute, however, may or may not necessarily be reflected in the collective bargaining agreement. I believe that recently, collective bargaining between District Council 24 and the state produced a statutory change providing state employees with the opportunity to apply unused but accumulated sick leave or perhaps accrued benefits of time off otherwise toward the cost of their retiree health insurance benefit. To the extent that that is a product of collective bargaining and to the extent that that agreement is only binding for the length contract for District Council 24. Conclusions I'm not sure I could reach without further study. Then the holding of the Court of Appeals would limit the implementation or effectiveness of the ability to change unilaterally without negotiations those terms to the length of any collective bargaining agreement between District Council 24 and the state of Wisconsin. In other words, upon the expiration of agreement, the state could unilaterally terminate the entitlement of union's employees to receive such a benefit. That is our fear. That is why we rise today.
Thank you, Counselor.
What was your second point again about two-tier benefits?
Under Schlosser, we have private sector employees not enjoying the benefit of union representation, probably middle managers and above, at Alice Chalmers, employees who are in fact employees at will, with no employment, who have been told by their employer that they are entitled to receive paid life insurance for life. When the Alice Chalmers, invoking a clause in a policy that it had that it could unilaterally change that benefit at any time, did so, this court ruled that that was a violation of a secured benefit, of a vested benefit, although I don't believe, I'd have to check, I don't believe there was the word vested, as Mr. Hugin pointed out in reference to the union contract in this case. I don't believe the word vested appeared. This court ruled that under the language of that policy, that benefit had become vested because it had been promised to employees for life. And that rule will stand, although under it was life insurance in that case, there's no principled basis to distinguish health insurance from life insurance that comes to my mind anyway. And as a consequence, employees who are not members of union will receive, even though they're employees at will, a vested right to receive the promises of their employers. I see that my time is up.
It is. You may have one long sentence to summarize your argument, Mr. Hawks, and then
I'll use that opportunity to close by pointing out the circuits of the federal bench are divided on this question. The Court of Appeals' reliance on the Seventh Circuit does not enjoy support from the Sixth Circuit. That similar issues have reached the Sixth Circuit, or have the Fifth Circuit, in a case entitled International Association of Machinists versus Masonite Corporation, where the Court of Appeals remanded the matter to the trial court for decision using extrinsic evidence if necessary to determine the factual dispute in the case. I would also like to point to the court's attention that counsel ran across three cases involving the application of state law in preparation for this oral argument. We're not prepared to argue them, but as an assistance to the court, we would be glad to share those citations if you are interested in them.
Thank you. You may send them, but send them to opposing counsel to ask.
Thank you very much.
Justice Babbage.
You ask us to send this back to determine the party's intent. Then in section 2 of your brief, you ask us to also talk about what the rule of law is with respect to presumptions, the presumption of vesting, etc. Now, wouldn't that, if we do what you want us to do, send it back, why would we engage in any discussion with respect to the presumption of vesting or lack of presumption? Wouldn't that be mere dicta?
Yes. And it would not be necessary if you send the case back for further findings with regard to the facts in the record or a decision that further evidence is necessary to resolve the dispute.
Is that counsel?
Right?
Go ahead.
I find that answer, I think, inconsistent with your brief, or at least my memory of your brief. Maybe I'm reading Bidlock. You relied on Bidlock, and maybe I'm reading Bidlock into it. But I understood you to argue that you have to send, it should be sent back. And if it is unclear what the intent of the parties were on this issue, then you resort to the rule of law presumptions. That's what I understood your brief to advance, and that's what I heard your joint co-counsel advancing in his comment when he said you very well could find that no one mentioned the issue in negotiations. I mean, it may be that it is inconclusive, then you have to rely on a rule of law. That's what I thought you argued in your brief. Am I incorrect?
Uh, Are you incorrect about what we argued in our brief? I am not sure.
Okay.
I'm following the entire question. But let me say this in an effort to answer the question. We join counsel...
Page 6 of your brief, I think, had that.
We join counsel for plaintiffs' conclusion that the language in that contract is sufficient to permit an inference that the intent of the parties was to continue this benefit after the expiration of the contract. And this is a section of my argument I didn't have a chance to get to. I think I can work it in at this point. We negotiate benefits for retirees' health insurance, for retirees. We negotiate them oftentimes with a condition, the clauses in these contracts. Amici's have hundreds of labor contracts and their affiliates. They are widely different from contract to contract. Some have nothing about retiree health insurance. Others have perfectly clear language on vesting into the future. But most say these sorts of things. Early retirement, a retiree can retire as early as 50 under the protective services, and believe me, there are profound problems for protective services employees at the consequences of the holding of the years. But the clause will read, upon the arrival of an event or an age, employee shall receive health insurance until he or she reaches age 65. Employee shall receive health insurance until he or she reaches the age at which Medicare coverage begins. When a union proposes to an employer that its members covered under the contract at that time are to receive retirement health insurance benefit until age 65, I believe it is apparent to them and to the employer that they are talking about a period of time that must extend beyond the expiration date of the contract, or it will have no meaning at all. And we don't believe we generally negotiate clauses that have little or no meaning. A benefit for retirees to receive health insurance at age 65. If you had no one in the bargaining unit age 62 or older, that benefit becomes entirely illusory under the holding of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Mr. Hawks. Ms. Nussloch?
Thank you, Your
Honor. Representing the City of Glendale. Ms. Nussloch, you may lower the height of that podium if you're more comfortable. There is a button on your left. Yep. High tech.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Kathy Nussloch. Together with my co-counsel, Greg Ledevsky, of the law firm of Davis & Keelthaugh, we represent the City of Glendale. And we are asking that this Court affirm both the trial court and the Court of Appeals decision, which states that under the contract language of the collective bargaining agreements, the health insurance benefits are not vested benefits, but in fact were subject to negotiation. If I were to sum up the City of Glendale's position in this case in one sentence, I would say, not all retirement benefits are created equal. I have 3 points that I'd like to present to the court. One is that different vehicles or instruments are used to grant different benefits to both current employees and to retired employees. There can be an individual contract, such as in Schlosser, or there can be collective bargaining agreements, such as in Senn, or there can be some combination. And I submit to the court that Schlosser and Senn are not contradictory, as plaintiff's counsel, appellant's counsel would have us believe, but that the holdings of each case must be examined relative to the facts of each case. The second point that I'd like to elaborate before the court is that there are different benefits which vest under different circumstances. We know, for example, that ERISA mandates the vesting of pension benefits and other retirement compensation, but it specifically does not mandate the vesting of welfare benefits, such as health insurance. We know that the Wisconsin Retirement Fund, in conjunction with the Internal Revenue Code, mandates the vesting of pension benefits, but again is silent on the issue of welfare benefits. So that in order to examine vesting, if you can't rely upon law such as ERISA or state statute which mandate vesting, you must look to whether whether the employer has created vested benefits by contract. Alternatively, if the employer chooses not to do that, the employer can create benefits which are offered to current employees and to retired employees which are of limited duration.
Now, does the contract say that? Does the contract say that these health benefit provisions of the contract apply to retirees only for the two-year collective bargaining agreement and can be renegotiated?
The contract does not say that in so many words, although...
Tell me what language you're relying on.
I'm relying primarily upon SEN, which says where the...
Not in your contract.
In the contract...
Give me the language.
There is a clause between 1972, I think it is, and 1973 and 1989, which provides that, for example, employee contribution...
Okay, what page are we looking at?
If we look at the Respondent's Appendix, page 9,
okay.
Looking at the agreement, this is a portion of the agreement for 79-80, under E, which establishes the eligibility requirements, paragraph 6, it says employee contribution remains a negotiable item upon the expiration of this two-year agreement.
What number is that?
E6 on page
employee
R.
Employee contribution remains a negotiable item upon the expiration of this two-year agreement. That's what you're relying on.
Yes.
But that language was not present. That was inserted when? 1980 or something?
I believe it was in 1977, and at the time that it was inserted, it says that the benefits or the ability to negotiate the contribution would remain a negotiable item. So even though the contracts that we've submitted to the court, starting with 1972, did not use that sentence, by including the statement in the 1977 agreement that the employee contribution remains a negotiable item, there is at least the implication that in earlier agreements, the union and the employer accepted that as a negotiable item.
Now, did that come in every other contract?
It came in
77.
It came in every contract until I think 1989 through 91. I think was the last year that had that language in it, and then the language dropped.
And then what?
Then that language was not included in the, I think it's the 92, 94, and 95, 97 agreement.
No, my question would be, in just reading that, this is on Appendix 9, talks about on top, retired employees will be eligible for the health insurance benefits provided. In this one, and we know that it's now 15 years, but of course this one has at least 10 years. And that was later changed to 15. Okay.
Yes.
Now, my question is, well, who represents the retired employee? I mean, after they have retired, what I'm hearing is that nobody does. But you're saying that the union continues, even if there's a new union comes in or the union is voted out or whatever, that they're bound by whatever happens after that. That seems to be your position.
My position is not that the union represents the retirees. I think under the Allied Chemical case, which both sides have referred to, that the union does not represent the retirees. The retirees are not part of the collective bargaining unit. They are not entitled to representation at the collective bargaining table, and the union does not represent them. However, the union... the subject of retirement benefits are a permissive subject of bargaining between the employer and the union, such that the union can and the employer can discuss retirement benefits or benefits to the retirees.
How could they change them, though, if the retirees are not represented?
The benefits...
I mean, clearly the union and the employer can deal with an employee. employee then in the employment who is considering retirement and retires in the next 2 years, or whatever the collective bargaining agreement is, how can you deal with past retirees?
The benefits that are offered under the collective bargaining agreements are offered for a limited term. Because those benefits expire at the end of that term, the retirees are not entitled to benefits beyond that term.
Well, but that's the issue in the case. You're declaring that the law, but that's the issue here. Are you right?
The issue
and
here...
The only way you can deal with that, if you're right, then of course the retirees don't have to be represented because whatever they get is a gift to them.
Yes, and I think BIDLAC says that. I think if the benefits are not vested, and the issue here is whether the benefits are vested, because if the benefits are not vested, the benefits are in fact a gift. They are a third-party beneficiary to the contract that's negotiated between the union on behalf of the current employees and the employer.
Well, are you saying that at the bargaining table, management and labor could agree that for all retirees, insurance benefits are wiped out?
Yes. I am saying they have the capability of doing that. I am also saying that I don't think that it is likely that they would.
Does that make sense to you, that the retirees who are not present at the bargaining table, who are losing what they, I would assume, perceive to be a benefit that they had bargained for, are suddenly without any health insurance at all and have nothing to say about it?
I think that it is a harsh result. I think other courts have looked at that issue and have agreed that it is a harsh result and that the retirees may end up without the benefits that they thought they had, but where that expectation is a unilateral expectation and where the benefit is not vested, that is a possible result.
What sense does it make then to say 10 years or 15 years or 20 years? What's the logic of that in response to your last answer?
In terms, if your question, Your Honor, is why make it 10 years of credible service as opposed to 15? In part, it is a negotiating point with the union.
For what purpose?
Because the union, although they do not represent the retirees and are not required to negotiate on behalf of the retirees, may negotiate. And we're looking at union negotiators and people who are looking towards retirement themselves. They historically have discussed retirement benefits, and in looking at what the employer shall require before retirement benefits can be granted, the union can negotiate whether that term will be 10 years or 15 years with the hope and the aspiration that they will fall within that creditable years of service. But
counsel, what if, let's say, Mrs. Smith retired here with 10 years of service in 1985. And I understand from 1972 to 1989, in order to be eligible for health care benefits, you have to have completed at least 10 years. So let's say Mrs. Smith in 1985 completed her 10 years, and she's having that health insurance paid right along. Then in 1989, it's changed to 15 years. Are you saying then with that change that Mrs. Smith then no longer has any entitlement whatsoever to health insurance?
Yes, Your Honor, I am. Under the terms of this collective bargaining agreement, the series of collective bargaining agreements.
And so Mrs. Smith, and now let me just change the numbers a little bit. Let's just say Mrs. Smith has worked 25 years as a secretary at some company, and been a good loyal employee, and she retired. And lo and behold, the company pays her medical insurance because she's worked 25 years. But the next contract they negotiate, she's not negotiating, it's the union and the employer, that they say, oh, gotta be 30 years to vest. And so for the rest of her life, she's no longer entitled to that benefit. Is that your interpretation?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. And I realize that that's a hard thing to stand up here and say, that that is not a...
Especially if I were Mrs. Smith.
That's right. That it is not a sympathetic position to take. And in fact, in this case, when that provision was changed from 10 years to 15 years, the change actually took place effective January 1 of 1987, and at that time, none of the...
They all had 15 years.
They all had 15 years.
One point for clarification, if I may. Did I hear you to argue that you are conceding that the Court of Appeals opinion is erroneous when it says that there is... representation by the union of the employees. At page 5, it says there's implied, thus this acceptance implies that they've consented to have the union negotiate on their behalf. That seems to be something different than what you're saying.
I do think, with all respect to the lower court, I do think that the Court of Appeals was wrong
In the implied representation.
That was not a point that was argued by, certainly not by appellants. It was not argued by the City of Glendale. I think that the court struggled with the harshness of the decision that was made on the contractual language and looked for a way perhaps to balance that decision. But I do think that the court was wrong. I also think that that was an alternative finding, that it does not make it necessary for this court to reverse the entire decision and send it back. I think, however, that this court should affirm on the contractual language, but should not affirm on the implicit representation. I do think that is contrary to the language in Allied Chemicals, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case.
What if this came to us in the posture, not of summary judgment, but there had been a trial, and or at least depositions taken, and every retiree testified that at least when they retired and when the collective bargaining agreements were struck, it was their intent that these would vest upon their retirement. In other words, I'm getting to the intent of the parties. How do you address that, and particularly the
I think that your situation falls squarely in the facts of Vidlak and in Sen. And if I can just kind of run through this history for a minute, in Sen, the Seventh Circuit said, where the collective bargaining agreement or the contract is silent as to vesting, there is a presumption that there is no vesting. Vidlak backed off of that a little bit, and Vidlak said, where the contract is silent as to vesting, there is a presumption that there is no vesting. However, that presumption can be rebutted. In order to rebut that presumption, we will look in the record to see if there is extrinsic evidence to show either that there is an ambiguity in the contract or what the party's intent is. And we only look to intent if there is an ambiguity in the contract. So I said that in a kind of a circular fashion, but if the contract is clear on its face, if it is silent, there is a presumption of vesting. In Vidlak, the court found that the contract terms were vague because there was some reference to a spouse after death, and they said, we will look to extrinsic evidence in the record. And in Vidlak, there was, I think the court used the term, a great deal of extrinsic evidence that demonstrated that the parties had an intent to vest, and the parties intended these benefits to be lifetime benefits. And if we had that same scenario here, then perhaps you could say, let's look at the evidence in the record and see if there was an intent to vest. I would say, first off, this contract is not vague. It doesn't have the same language that was in Vidlak, which made the contract vague. There isn't a reference to spousal support after the death of the employee. There also isn't any evidence in this record to demonstrate the party's intent, the employee's intent. Plaintiffs, or appellants now, filed this motion for summary judgment. They said there are no disputed facts. We are prepared to submit this to the court for a decision on the record. They did not present any affidavits from the individual retirees saying, when I went to work for the city of Glendale, I was promised lifetime health insurance benefits. They didn't present a letter, as there existed in Schlosser, saying, when you retire, or upon your retirement, congratulations, you are now the beneficiary of lifetime benefits. And so whereas in Vidlak, you might want to, or in Vidlak, the court said, we have enough extrinsic evidence to say there is a dispute of fact. This should go back for a decision. This was not appropriate for summary judgment. We don't have that here. Moreover, in Murphy affirmed again, maybe you would say revitalized Sen, and also interpreted Vidlak and said, where the contract is silent on vesting, the presumption is no vesting.
Now, I understand that under Sen, if the agreement doesn't employ the word vest or lifetime or other clear vesting, then the presumption against vesting governs, the document is deemed unambiguous and resort to extrinsic evidence is barred. Is that correct? Sen, in effect, is an irrebuttable presumption.
Yes, and Vidlak said, no, that presumption can be rebutted.
And if I understood, at least Judge Posner thought it was a weak no vest rule.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Didn't Schlosser, at least inferentially, create a rule the opposite of what you're arguing for? Didn't Schlosser create a rule of if the language is a presumption of vesting?
Schlosser was a completely different situation. And in Schlosser, first of all, they were not union employees. They were, each employee was given, in effect, an employment contract. They were told that they would have life insurance benefits or life insurance coverage without cost for their life. Upon retirement, they each received the letter that I was talking about that said, congratulations on your retirement. This will confirm that you have lifetime free life insurance. That contract wasn't changed over the entire existence of all the years that the retirees were talking about until the year in question when Alice Chalmers asked for a contribution. There was also testimony from a former president of Alice Chalmers, I think it was, to the effect that the purpose of offering these lifetime guaranteed life insurance benefits was to respond to an increase in the union benefits and to attract and maintain high-quality personnel. That occurred, that was to explain the reason why in 1930, when Alice Chalmers first provided life insurance benefits, there was an employee contribution. In 1956, the company changed the benefits offered and said there will no longer be a contribution necessary. So we have extrinsic evidence in Schlosser, which says we had a contract, it was meant to be for lifetime, and the purpose of that was to attract high quality and maintain high quality personnel. Coupled with, again, the fact that each employee received a confirming letter upon retirement saying, you get this for life. There is a much different situation than we have here in Roth, where we have a series of 12 or 13 collective bargaining agreements, each of a limited duration. Some are 1 year, some are 2 years, some are 3 years, but they are of limited duration. And so, and during those terms, as the collective bargaining agreement changed, different terms of the agreement, including different terms relating to health insurance, changed.
But didn't Alice Chalmers in its distribution say, we're not bound, we can change this at any time?
Alice Chalmers, in the Alice Chalmers insurance booklets said that.
That's
yes.
Right. And the employees got the booklets.
The employee received the booklets.
So they were told that Alice Chalmers can do it any time, change it. And yet the court said, no, Alice Chalmers could not change it. It was vested. There you had express language beyond question, right?
In the insurance booklets, but not in the contract with the employees or with the collective bargaining agreement. So the distinction is that the contract was created with the employee separate from the insurance booklet, which described the benefits that were available. Whereas in this case, the benefit itself is created for a limited term because it's created solely in that collective bargaining agreement, which expires at the end of its duration.
I noticed that, and I noticed in G that you referred to it. Every sentence in 1 through 9 refers to an employee who retires. The only sentence that does not refer to an employee who retires is the one you're relying on. The employee contribution remains a negotiable item upon the expiration of this one-year agreement. Sounds to me as if that doesn't cover a retired employee. Just look at it. One, he, she, the retiree. Two, the retiree. Three, any employee who retires. Four, any employee who, after retiring. Five, the retiree should be eligible. Seven, That doesn't talk about retiree, but the city of Glendale agrees to pay the full cost of health insurance benefits minus the employee contribution of $974. So that talks about the employee. And eight is very interesting. It says that should the government provide a health care plan for retired employees, the parties to this agreement would renegotiate the benefit and agreement relative to providing the same or substantially equal coverage and the matter of contribution towards the payment of such coverage. Sounds as if they're going to give them the same. as under this agreement?
First of all, if I can address your first point first, and that is under 6, since it does not refer to a retired employee, why should the court consider that as a retirement benefit or a modification affecting the retired benefits? And that is because it falls under the clause determining when retired employees will be eligible for the health insurance benefit. Although this contract may not be the most artfully drafted as we go back and parse out the sentences, points 1 through 9 all relate to E, which is retired employees. Under sub 7, where we talk about, or where the collective bargaining agreement talks about the contribution of employees to the health insurance, there is, in clause 7, there is a specific statement that the city of Glendale will pay the single coverage, but the employees are required to, employees, including the retired employees, are required to contribute $9.74 for
family.
Does it
say retired employees?
It does not say retired employees in paragraph 7, yes, but the implication, to read that as a whole, the clause does say that if Mr. George Weiss should retire in 1979, the city will make him eligible for the benefit prior to January 1 of 1980. In other words, if Mr. George Weiss retired on January 1 of 1980, he would fall into this category where he would be required to contribute $9.74.
That may be true, but what about the guy that retired before January 1, 1980?
He's required to contribute $9.74 for family coverage.
Doesn't say it, though.
It does not say specifically those words, but that is the manner.
It covers the man or woman who's going to retire January 1, 1980. I mean, that's the issue in this case, right?
Yes.
Okay. You know, what distresses me on the one hand is I am going to retire. Now, I've got a choice of continuing to work, right?
Yes.
Or I have a choice of retiring. And I have that choice. If I'm going to continue work, I know what my salary is going to be, or hope I know what it's going to be, and assume that the employer is going to retain me and that I will get that. If I decide to retire, I'm going to look at my benefits, right?
Yes.
And unless it's absolutely clear to me from this contract that my union has negotiated for me, I mean, I am going to rely on the fact that my benefits are going to stay the same and that the union, who has no obligation, indeed cannot represent me, can't sell me out. Right? I mean, that's what I would think. So it strikes me that the presumption should be that unless there's language that says otherwise, that I should be presumed to keep my same benefits, unless the feds or the state government provide a health care, and then the company should give me, as it says here, substantially equal coverage with, and as I read it, the matter of contribution. So otherwise, why would I retire? It's too risky. I mean, my biggest expense as a retiree in advanced years is going to be health care. I just read that in...
Modern Maturity?
No. I could have read it there, but it was in USA Today or the New York Times, which had a chart.
What's Modern Maturity?
Which had a chart. And that chart showed that at particular ages, what sums in a budget increase or decrease. And health care was one of these ones that does increase. So if I'm going to retire, it seems to me that's what I'm going to look at. And so I'm not sure I even agree with BIDLAC as to where the presumption should be. On the other hand, since healthcare is such a large cost today, it's a large cost to employers. And the large cost to the employers means that an employer can, by this kind of agreement, incur huge expenses when business may be going downhill. Now, you know, Alice Jom has had significant economic difficulties. I haven't read or seen, and it's not part of the case, that it was because of the health care costs. But, I mean, that's what the balance is here. Right?
Yes,
Your Honor. Who should take the hit when the contract is not absolutely clear?
If I can address the points that you raised somewhat in the order that you raised them, first of all, you as the retiree have... What your presumption was is that you as the retiree retired because you could expect these health insurance benefits.
Yeah.
But you as the retiree, if you've served your credible years of service with the City of Glendale or under the Wisconsin Retirement Fund, the 20 years that are required in the state system, whatever it might be, have seen a series of collective bargaining agreements. And the benefits that were offered under those collective bargaining agreements were in effect only for that term. So, for example, if you were Rita Roth, you saw from 1972 through 1997 changes in the health insurance benefits that you were offered. You saw changes in the plan providers. You saw changes in the number of years. You saw changes in the benefits that were provided because it is virtually impossible for a plan under Blue Cross Blue Shield to be the same and provide the same benefits as what is offered under the state health plan. Unless you have plans that exactly mirror one another, you as the retiree have seen that your benefits change and they are...
Do they go up or down when they changed?
It was various. The change in the provider, I'd have to examine what was offered, but there were various levels provided. There was an option for Blue Cross Blue Shield. There was an option for four different HMOs. There's an option for state health plan, which includes maybe a range of eight different options that are offered. So whether the benefits offered under each option went up or down would take an examination of each different health plan. So you are not the Schlosser retiree who sat back and said, my benefits have never changed. I've had these. It's been the same since I started working here, and it's always going to be the same. What you have is benefits that were granted for a duration, a limited duration. If I can address your second point, and I know that I'm out of time, you asked why this court shouldn't adopt really the rationale that has been adopted in Yarriman under the Sixth Circuit. And to do that would create a disparity for employers between state court law and federal law. We have
I know that's your argument, but if I were in the Sixth Circuit, I'd get a different result than in the Seventh Circuit. So you don't have uniformity.
Oh, I understand that there isn't uniformity. And if you look at the circuits, I forget now what it is, First and Sixth certainly go with Yardman. Third Circuit is more in line with Sen, and different circuits fall in different places. But if this court adopts Yardman as the state law, we will have state law that says collective bargaining, that retirement benefits in a collective bargaining agreement, which is silent on vesting, are vested. And we will have federal law that says health insurance benefits, which are granted by virtue of a collective bargaining agreement in an agreement which is silent on vesting, are not vested.
Counsel, you talk about disparity. I mean, I read Bidlack different than you do, and the presumption that I read in Bidlack is different than the presumption that I hear you arguing. State again what you think the presumption of Bidlack is with regard to if the language is silent.
The presumption is if the language is silent, there is no vesting.
Then how do you square that with the language in the Bidlack opinion when Posner wrote on page 606, we reject the extreme position and says, gives the two extreme positions. The first is that the contract must either use the word vest or must state
unequivocally that it is creating rights that will not expire when the contract expires. And it goes, he goes on to say, you know, what that first one is really all about is just to make life easier for judges. And we can be sympathetic to that. I mean, I like the way he was talking. You know, I can be sympathetic to that, but to come up with some kind of formula to make life easy for judges is not what we're all about. So he seems to me, on page 606, rejecting the very argument that you're saying is a presumption. How do you respond to that?
In Bidlac, the court did say, and Judge Posner did say, that he was rejecting the two extremes, and he was rejecting the one extreme, which he said that the contract must use the term vest. However, he said you can rebut that. The presumption is there, but it can be rebutted, whereas in Sin it was an irrebuttable presumption. Under Bidlac, the presumption can be rebutted, and it can be rebutted by ambiguous evidence. So that Bidlac did say, okay, we aren't going to go way out here and say it's irrebuttable. We are going to say, however, that there is a presumption that if the collective bargaining agreement is silent as to vesting, there is no vesting. And that was affirmed or reaffirmed in Murphy.
The presumption that he's talking about is not that. The presumption that he's talking about, the paragraph before that, is, therefore, as Sen and many other cases hold, Litton, presume that a collective bargaining agreement ceases to obligate the employer when the agreement term, 3 years, is up. That's the presumption. Then he goes on to say the next sentence, but it's not an irrebuttable presumption. And the next sentence is, rights which accrue or vest under the collective bargaining agreement will, as a general rule, survive termination. So it's the presumption that they expire at the end of each term. That, I mean, do you agree that's the presumption he's discussing there?
I agree that is the presumption, and I don't see that that is different from saying that they don't vest. I mean, either the presumption either is that the benefits do not survive the duration of the contract, meaning the presumption is they do not vest if the contract is silent, or the alternative would be that there is some benefit that survives the duration of the contract.
Could I ask one question?
Certainly.
If the collective bargaining agreements are as clear as you indicate, why didn't the city move for summary judgment?
I can't answer that question, Your Honor. I was not the attorney who represented the city of Glendale at the trial court level. And I can't ask it. I would be guessing, but I don't know.
Counsel, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Nugent? Mr. Nugent, how do you explain that language that we've been looking at? Let's see, what is page 17, 6, under G. The employee contribution remains a negotiable item upon expiration of this one-year agreement.
I can't explain that. That language, as I read it, means that for current employees, they keep it as a negotiable item. As a matter of fact, if summary judgment were not granted to the city of Glendale, we'd go back and have a trial, and you would undoubtedly hear testimony that they thought they were negotiating for the current employees. They gave up something, didn't they? When they agreed to change the insurance coverage, it means that people who then retire will have to pay part of the premium. As a matter of fact, some of the employees have already retired after this language, and they are paying part of the premium, and they're not plaintiffs in this case. So I read the language about it being a negotiable item that is to apply to current employees. Since the union recognized that they don't represent the retired people. Unions have tried over the years to represent retirees. Many times retired people come to the union and they say, you know, when we retired, our pension's only $200 a month. and it doesn't go very far. Can't you go back to that employer and see if you can get us a few more dollars? And unions have tried, and the first thing they're greeted with is a statement, you do not represent the retirees. I guess everyone agrees with that, including opposing counsel here today, well, except everyone except the Court of Appeals. They don't represent the retirees. The question that we have to decide here today is, well, who does represent them? If the union can't represent them, then I say, why can't they represent themselves? At Allied Chemical, they did represent themselves, and the employer went right directly to the retirees, and they worked out some kind of an agreement. By the way, you'll never get all of the retirees to agree, because some of them, because of advanced age, could be in nursing homes. They could have guardians. Some could be in nursing homes and need guardians, but they don't have one. So even in Allied Chemical, I noticed that the benefit or change that they made was not passed along to the people who did not agree. It was only passed along to the people who did agree. Now, I take issue with counsel when she refers to the health insurance benefit as a gift. I've never thought it was a gift when we're at the bargaining table. We negotiate for those benefits, and when they set 10 years and then later 15 years of work, how has it become a gift? It's something that the people earned, just like in Schlosser. All of these people could tell you that they gave up other offers of employment that may have called for higher pay in order to keep their health insurance benefit. So I don't see it as a gift at all. And also, the plaintiffs here, as I pointed out, are not just union people. As a matter of fact, one of them is the city former city clerk of the city of Glendale, and she's pretty shocked to find out that her health insurance benefit is changed. Rita Roth, who has the first name of the plaintiff, she's sitting here watching us today, and when she retired, she felt very comfortable that I worked many years. By the way, they all worked 25 years. They didn't work just 15, and she had that comfort of knowing at least her health insurance will be paid for by the city from now on, and much to her dismay, they want her to pay part of the premium, which she has been doing ever since they made the change. Also, I want to point out, we're not talking about a full health insurance benefit. This is a benefit that goes into effect when they reach 65, and actually we're talking about a supplemental benefit. And counsel, in her brief, I know she says, we're arguing that the benefit should be paid forever. She actually uses the word forever. Well, we're not arguing that. Life is not forever, as we all know. And because of the advanced age, we're starting at 65. Forever is not forever. It's something quite short of that. I believe that in SEN and some of the federal cases where they have ruled that the benefits terminate at the end of the labor agreement, when I read those agreements, I see sunset language. If you read SEN, you will see it says clearly, for the term of this agreement. And it's perfectly possible to write sunset language into a labor agreement, which means when the contract ends, the benefit ceases. There is no such language in the Glendale contract. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eugen. That ends our oral argument on 97-3467. Thank you to counsel. We will.